Welcome to Creative Conversations. I'm Roger Humphrey. In this episode, I'm pleased to welcome the award-winning pianist, Terry Eder. Please join us as we talk about her new album, her love of Hungarian music, especially Béla Bartók, and so much more. Hey, before we begin, please hit the like, follow, and subscribe buttons, and all of the other buttons that you happen to see down there. Also, leave a comment. It's an easy thing to do, and it really helps the channel a bunch. Thanks. And we are welcoming to the show the wonderful award-winning pianist, Terry Eder. Hi, Terry. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hello, Roger. Good morning. And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Hey, it's my pleasure and my honor. So you're a wonderful pianist. I've been listening to your music recently as in preparation for this. It's one of the nice things about the show is I get introduced to CDs that I might not ever hear. That's a problem with classical music. We kind of slide under the radar whether we want to or not. So,
right.
So anyway, I was listening and just it's beautiful. Now you specialize in Hungarian stuff, right?
I do.
And how did that come about?
Well, thank you for asking. It's an interesting story. Started by coincidence in that I had several teachers of Hungarian ancestry or Hungarian birth, including at my undergrad and my graduate work. And I really wanted to go to Europe to study, having been born and raised in the States, and I'd actually never been to Europe when I was in grad school. And my teacher at the time, Balint Vajony, who was Hungarian, suggested that I go to study in Budapest. He thought, he said, it's a wonderful place. He grew up there. He had left in 1956 and come to the States. And I knew nothing about Budapest, but I investigated government grants to get money to go abroad.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like Budapest was not the most popular place at the time. It was, of course, still the Iron Curtain.
That must have been an interesting.
Absolutely was fascinating.
Culture shock there.
And to make a long story short, I started learning Bartók when I was at Indiana University in grad school. And I did indeed get awarded this major grant to go to Budapest and study Hungarian music, primarily Hungarian 20th century music, in Budapest, working with Zoltán Kocsis. And off I went, and I spent a year in Hungary. I started learning the language before my audition and interview for the grant.
Sure.
And I had language study as part of my grant award. So I became fluent in Hungarian, and I really just immersed myself in Hungarian culture, Hungarian people, Hungarian food. The music life is so rich there. And I really felt an affinity for the music there and really became enmeshed in it. And ever since, I've played a lot of it.
Well, you sure have. You've played it beautifully, I might add.
Thank you.
I know that for a while, the music of Bartók, for example, was a little difficult for a lot of people to listen to.
Sure.
Do you find that the audiences are more open to that now?
I think it depends how it's presented. I think that a lot of people perform Bartók in a very percussive manner. And certainly there is some percussive aspects to Bartók. But Bartók himself was known to have said that the melodic aspects of his music were very important. And using so much material based on folk song, one can readily understand that song, singing, and spoken language is very important in his music. And I find that if it's presented, that is performed in such a manner that language to song, then they're much more receptive than they may otherwise be.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I think that one of the difficulties I had, I'm a guitar guy and I used to teach at college, and I would explain to my students that when you're dealing with instrumental music, you have to find that melody, and when you're practicing it, even hum the melody, so that that whole melodic structure needs to be there. And I hear a lot of guitar players today, who classical guitar players today, who just are absolutely pristine, and their playing is crisp, but there's no melody line. You can't hum. It takes about 15 seconds, and you're tired of it. And so it's all technical. So when you find one, for me, when I find a musician who knows what a melody is, and can form that overall structure and that line, I gravitate towards that in a heartbeat. So
I'm
that's
with
hard.
you.
And in contemporary music, it's there also, but you have to look for it.
Definitely.
We're sitting here talking about this. Let's see what I can do about maybe coming up with see if we can listen to a little bit of Bartok here. We have from one of the bagatelles. Would you like to tell us what we're listening to here?
This is from the Bagatelles, the Allegro Giocoso.
Now you make that sound like it's easy, but I don't think it is.
No, it certainly is not.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. I really love it. I'll kind of bail out here, to listen to Bartok, I've played a couple of simple pieces by Bartok on the guitar, and it's challenging because it's so different from what I'm used to,
Sure.
and so that's. For me, part of it is just kind of getting used to that a little bit, but it's wonderful music. So,
Oh, I quite agree. I quite agree. But it is unique, and to a large extent, it has to do with the Hungarian language. The accentuation of the Hungarian speech
oh,
is
how's that?
reflected very much in the music. Well, in Hungarian, every word is accented on the first syllable.
Oh,
And
okay.
so you have a lot of that kind of rhythm in music, like the dun-da. That kind of accentuation comes from the speech. So it's very helpful to know the language and how that is spoken. So much of the folk music is based on actual lyrics and actual songs that
Oh.
Bartok collected. He was an ethnomusicologist, and he traveled greatly in Hungary and also in other countries and collected and cataloged and recorded folk songs and used many of them, some of them verbatim, which he then set to different harmonies and different phrasings, and some of them which eventually were original folk songs, such as in the improvisations.
Okay. He was very influential on so many other people during his lifetime. So it's listening to it now. I had a friend who in the 19 late 1970s, I believe, took first place at a Bartok competition on a piano, and the judge was Bartok's last living student, according to. My friend's name is Takis Pizanas, and he was a wonderful pianist, and as you can imagine. So we've had some conversations about Bartok. I came to classical music myself late. I didn't come, I came from a folk music background, so I didn't start playing classical until I was at the age where most people are starting their careers. I was 22 or 23. And so my depth of ignorance was amazing. And so I've always relied on my friends to kind of educate me a little bit. So and he did a little bit about Bartok. So and I became a fan of Bartok's music, amongst other things.
Lovely.
So yeah, it's great. That's great. Now there was one other clip that I wanted to play real quick, and there we go. And I'm going to let you kind of explain to us who we're listening to and what we're listening to. Dohnányi, did I say that right?
Yes, you did. This is Dohnányi, another Hungarian composer, and this is the Canzonetta, Opus 41.
Canzonetta, yes. Listening to some of these other pieces, this and amongst other pieces, last couple of days as I was getting ready for this, and I just fell in love with some of this. As a matter of fact, I think one of the pieces, and I'm not sure which one yet, I believe I'm going to transcribe for like two or three guitars, because it's so lovely. And this is a composer I don't know anything about. Can you tell us a little bit about this guy?
Sure. So Dohnányi, as you can hear, composed in a very romantic style through much of his life. He became a little more modern in later years. And you can hear that actually in this set of pieces, Opus 41, in that there are some impressionistic sounding pieces and some unusual harmonies that you wouldn't normally find in romantic music. But his model really was Brahms. And he actually met Brahms. He was born in the late 1800s and performed for Brahms and really took him as a role model. So many of his pieces belong in that vein. He composed a couple of rhapsodies, as did Brahms, and many short pieces, short characteristic pieces. He was a very well-known figure. He was a concert pianist himself. He performed around the world. He also taught at the Liszt Academy, and he composed. And he, too, left Hungary, I believe, either during or just after World War II. And he settled in Florida and had a teaching position in Florida. As a matter of fact, my teacher in Indiana, the other Hungarian, Balin Bajani, studied with Dohnányi.
Oh, okay. So the music is absolutely lovely, and I think that we get into. There's a tendency, I think, for the uninitiated to think of some of this music as being sort of exotic, perhaps, or something. Right. And in fact, it's just absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, I wouldn't have a problem at all programming this if I was still a performer. It's just beautiful music. So I'm very appreciative of the fact that you've been doing it and you're kind of pushing it forward. So
well, I'm so glad you're responsive to it. That's lovely to hear.
Well, it's hard not to. I mean, if you like music, I just think that just tugs on the heartstrings. I mean, how can you not just kind of, that just settle into that? It's just absolutely beautiful. So now, how long were you in Budapest?
I was in Budapest for a year, just 1 year.
Boy, that can be a life changer, though.
It really was. It made quite an impression on me. It was my first time in Europe, my first time in Eastern Europe behind the Old Curtain. And well, it was hard for me to know what I was experiencing, whether it was European, whether it was Hungarian, whether it was Soviet. You know, I had all these impressions, but I didn't know how to sort them out because
sure.
I had never been anywhere else in Europe.
Now, you're originally from Michigan.
Yes, I am.
Detroit. Me too.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I currently live in mid-Michigan. I spent my entire career teaching in Lansing in that area.
Oh, wonderful.
And then also, you mentioned earlier that you did your undergrad at Oberlin.
Yes.
And I taught for nearly 30 years at Olivet College, now University of Olivet, which is over by Battle Creek. And that was started by Father Shepherd after he got done starting Oberlin College.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
So he was a busy guy. I can't imagine starting one college, let alone two, and having
exactly.
them survive for as long as they have. So it's pretty amazing.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, yeah. So you Michigan, and then you went to Oberlin.
Yes.
Okay, so right to Oberlin, and from Oberlin
right to Oberlin, and then right to Bloomington, Indiana, for grad school, and from there I went to Budapest. And from Budapest I went to Canada, actually to Banff, the Banff Center for Fine Arts. At that time had a year-round program for artists.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and so I spent a year in Banff, Alberta,
It's cold
before.
there, but you're a Michigander. You're used to
Exactly. At the time, I was used to it.
Well, when did you land in New York?
When I was in my mid-20s, I moved to New York. I have been living, Budapest and then the mountains of Banff. And then I had a job in High Mesa country of Arizona. And very small community. And I needed some culture and some life around me. So I said, excuse me, I just put my water down. I said, New York is the place for me. And off I went. So I've been here ever since.
It's been, gosh, over 20 years since you did your Carnegie Hall debut. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Let me think. I think it's over 20 years, yes.
So, what was that experience like?
Oh, it was fabulous. It was really fabulous. And my debut was in WOW Recital Hall at Carnegie Hall. And I love the hall. And indeed, I've played there a couple of times since. And that is where I hold my series, Key Pianists, which I started 10 years
Let's
ago.
talk about that a minute. Now let's talk this key pianist. When did that begin?
So I began Key Pianists in 2015. It's going to be my 10th anniversary season for the
Oh,
series.
congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I started the series because I saw that there was a place in New York concert life for a different kind of series than there had been before. As a pianist myself, as a music lover, I've always attended a lot of concerts. And as a pianist, of course, I go to hear all the piano recitals in town, of which there are many.
Of course.
And I enjoy those to no end. But I found that there are two kinds of piano recitals generally one finds in New York City.
Which
And
is?
those are the young, up-and-coming, recent competition winners who are just embarking on a career. And the competition people will sponsor them in big concerts to introduce them to the public. And the other are the established artists who are very famous. We're talking Yu-Jo Wang and Lang Lang and people in those categories who come every year. They're heard quite often in New York City. And I found that there was nothing in between. And there are so many fine pianists who deserve an opportunity to play on a big New York stage and who audiences would love to hear, but who are not presented here and don't have the opportunity to play, certainly not on a Carnegie Hall stage. And I decided to start this series to present such artists.
So are these pianists that are New York City based, or are they national or international that come in for this? How does that work?
All kinds of pianists. Mostly they have been US based. However, I have had just last season, I had an English artist come from London, Danny Driver, wonderful, wonderful pianist, not known at all in the US. It was his debut in Carnegie Hall and an amazing pianist. To date, the rest of the artists I've invited to play have been US based, not all New York, but US based. And I'm hoping to expand and that I may have more international artists. I have one in particular in mind for next season, but it's too early to announce that artist. Some of them are college professors with performing careers. Elsewhere in the States, some of them are wonderful pianists who just don't get enough opportunities to play, but they're on the circuit, maybe in smaller cities. It can be everything from emerging artists to well-known artists who just haven't played in recent years or don't have enough opportunities to play. The truth is that there are not enough opportunities for musicians, and there are a lot of concert pianists and very few performing arts organizations that are continuing to present piano recitals, fewer and fewer as time goes on. And I saw that there was an opportunity to kind of fill that gap and bring wonderful artists who have something special. They have deep artistry, they have perhaps repertoire specialties, they have a kind of wisdom and beauty that you don't often hear in, well, musicians at all, but often in young competition winners who, as you mentioned earlier, there's often a real focus on technique, to the exclusion of more beautiful music making. And it's that kind of special quality that I look for in an artist. And I know that an audience will respond to them and that they will relish the opportunity to play at Carnegie Hall.
I commented recently, I don't know what made me think of this, but I commented recently that all right, growing up in the 60s, and one of the things that we used to kind of pride ourselves on was the underground music. And and you'd get all of these really great jazz and rock musicians who weren't top 40. But the underground music today, for me, is the classical stuff. But it's the popular music, and it's called pop music for a reason. People like it, and I get that. But it sucks all the oxygen out of the room. There's just no and so the classical music, we're playing to smaller and smaller venues, and to some extent that's good. I like that. I like I as a guitarist, I came up in the shadow of the Segovias and the Breams and people like that, and they were playing the big halls, and so you sort of felt like that had to be your aspiration. It was like an obligation to aspire to. And I understand the finances. You make more money selling 2,500 tickets than you do 500 tickets. I mean, it's and such, but I don't think the musical experience is nearly as good. I've sat in these big auditoriums, 2,500 or 3,000, 3,200 seats auditoriums, and the music was wonderful and the playing was great, but the experience was somewhat distant. And as a player, I know that I've played, I think the biggest audience I ever played to was about 1,500 people. And I didn't like it. And it wasn't because of nerves, because you're on a stage and you got lights in your face. You have no idea how many people are out there. You can hear them breathing. And in one case, I remember hearing one snoring, but that's another conversation. A true story though. But I've played in other settings where I'm only playing to 100 or 150 people, and you're looking them right square in the eyes. I mean, they're right there, and you're almost knees to knees with the first row, and I like that. It's more nerve-wracking, but I like the overall experience far and away better. And particularly with guitar, because guitar is such a quiet and intimate instrument, and so I really like that. So, but I think that we are, and I don't know how you feel about that, but I think we have become the underground. Other than a handful of our big artists, Lang Lang or Pearlman or somebody like that, but beyond that, there's a whole world of amazing musicians out there that
Yes, I agree.
we're not privy to at all.
That's right. I agree with you.
So it's one of the nice things about this podcast. I'm getting a chance to meet these people, which is great fun. Now, are you still performing? Do you perform, or have you kind of stepped away from that?
I am performing. In fact, I'm planning to play on my series this year in February
Good.
as a celebration of the 10th anniversary. year, and hopefully to thank my audience and give them hopefully a lovely recital as
Oh, I'm sure you
well.
will.
Thank you.
So you're doing that. When I was looking at a couple of your things on YouTube, I noticed that you were doing some accompanying also, with a vocalist, I believe, or more than one, perhaps. I was kind of zooming past that, getting to the solo stuff. So, but do you enjoy accompanying?
Gosh, I had no idea of what's on YouTube.
Oh.
But I do. I love playing with other people, both accompanying and chamber music. I love to do it whenever I get the opportunity. And I have played with singers, with flautists, with string players a lot, four hands piano. Enjoy all of that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of listening and participating in chamber. I love chamber. It's probably I love it all, but I think chamber is probably number one on the list, and particularly as a player, I far prefer to play chamber than I would in any other form. And I have over the years played quite a bit, and I've been it to me
Right.
that's like our form of a garage band,
I'm also less nervous when there's someone else sharing the spotlight with me.
particularly somebody you can trust. I've worked with a lot of musicians that were, well, let's say I was kind of a hired gun, and I was kind of backing them up, and that was nerve-wracking at times because some of them really shouldn't have been there. But when I'm working with another pro and somebody that I know and trust, and go through the, it's like, for me, walking out on stage, it was like, an extension of the rehearsal at that point. It's like, we're just going to sit here and play music. If you guys want to listen, that's okay. I don't care. It's very relaxed, and I play much better that way. So yeah, so your concert series at Carnegie is all solo piano, though, correct?
No, the first year that I had the series, I did include some chamber music, and I think that worked very well. Since then, I have only done solo piano, but I am open to the idea of including chamber music if the artist so desires and fits with the program and the other artists are equal quality and available and all those sort of contingencies. But the first year of the series, I had a Beethoven survey and a consisted of three concerts, an early Beethoven, middle period Beethoven, and late. And on each program, there was chamber music included. There was one of the piano trios, there was a song cycle, there was a violin sonata, the clarinet trio. So all different combinations.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so it worked quite well. So I'm not saying no, I'm not saying never. It could happen again.
Keep the options open.
That's right.
So
That's right.
now your program in February, what will you be playing?
Well, I haven't yet announced the program, and
Oh,
it's
okay.
perhaps not quite finalized, but I will include quite a bit of Bartok for sure, some Beethoven and Schubert, and some Debussy. That much I can say for certain.
That sounds. How do you go about choosing a program?
Oh,
Is there a process, or is it
of
just kind of?
course, there absolutely is. To me, choosing a program is very important. And I want a program to hold together as a program and to balance.
Now,
So,
to those who don't play or just listening, what does that mean?
okay,
I
well,
know, I kind of know what you mean, but
it means that the pieces complement each other. And rather than sounding like totally different blocks of music that could be on separate programs in separate universes,
oh, I see.
they complement each other and inform each other. So For example, I'm thinking that my program in February, it's February 12th, by the way,
Thank you.
will highlight a kind of folk element to all of the pieces, even though they're different composers from different eras. And that each of them will have some aspect of that folk song within their individual language. And that's what I mean by a well-constructed program, that there's something that unites the pieces, but allows them to speak individually. And a program that will appeal to an audience and speak to them. Other than that, it's kind of intangible.
Yeah, that's the way it is with me too. I look for a certain amount of contrast, key changes, time periods, tempo, long, short, any number of things like that
Certainly, you want
but at the same
contrast.
time you want the whole thing to flow almost like a conversation,
Exactly.
or like a play. And
Okay.
it's a narrow thread sometimes
It
to walk on, but it works pretty good. So now, do you do any work with like very contemporary modern music, or are you closer to the Hungarian thing and kind of focus more on that?
Yeah, I kind of focus more on that. I don't feel I'm a specialist in modern music. I mean, I play some Messiaen, I play some more modern composers than Dvorak, who died in 1945, so you can no longer call him modern. But I focus more on, I mean, I'm a big Beethoven player, a big Bartok player. Occasionally, I do like to play something ultra modern, but I wouldn't say I'm a specialist, or certainly not an exclusive 20th century, contemporary specialist.
I think kind of follow your heart as an artist, and I think that's where the best stuff is. So I was just kind of curious how that worked. Your series started in 2015. You got a severe interruption in 2020 and 2021.
I did.
What kind of an effect did that have on the overall program and how you do things?
Well, I mean, I did have a large gap. I mean, I had a program planned in 2020, in the spring of 2020. That was canceled because obviously Carnegie Hall closed. And that artist actually was coming from abroad and had other work in the States at the same time, which was also canceled. So I have not yet been able to re-engage that artist. And obviously the following season also was canceled, 2020, 2021. After that, I really felt unsure about how audiences were going to feel about coming out to concerts. And whether erroneously or not, my feeling was that if people were going to start going to concerts, they weren't going to go to as many. And they were most likely going to hear Ujamaa or another artist with that name recognition rather than go to a small series in a small hall where people are close to each other and still fearful for their health. So I took another year off to see how that played out and how cultural life was coming back. And I started back slowly to test the waters. I'm a self-funded venture, so I didn't want to put myself too much out on a limb and plan concerts and all the expenses that go with presenting at Carnegie Hall to have no audience. So I waited until I felt like people were starting to attend concerts again, my audience would come back, and indeed, the concerts have sold very well. We're back, And I think we're a known entity at this point. People know the series and feel that they're going to hear a wonderful artist if they come. And I'm so thankful for that.
That's terrific. Yes. So I have one off-the-wall question I want to ask real quickly.
Sure.
I don't know what made me think of this the other day when I was preparing. But in the world of popular music, one of the scary things that's happening right now is artificial intelligence. And I have heard some artificial intelligence attempts at writing music in the style of Bach or Handel, and it's dreadful. It's just awful. But it's early yet. And so, do you envision a day when a program could write a worthy piece of music in the style of a Bartok? And it, you know, I mean, it's just all of a sudden, this is a whole new world that we're looking at, and I'm just wondering. You know, I can see it's easy enough to get a computer to play the music. I do it all the time for things that I arrange. I use it as a but the sound is crappy, number one, and number two, it plays the notes exactly without having any artistry. It doesn't breathe. The music doesn't breathe at all. You can tell it's
Sure.
a computer just kicking it out. But I've wondered about the perhaps the possibility of a program, an AI program, actually composing a piece of music in the style, and in what, and whether or not the musicians would be interested in playing.
Well, I'm sure it will happen, and I'm sure it can. I'm sure there's a program, whether it exists now or it will exist in the future, that can do just what you say. They can absorb the style and the whole repertoire of a certain composer and spit something out in its style. Whether or not it would have the same cohesiveness as a piece
Right.
and the same intention behind it, I think would be very hard to do because I don't think a computer can sense.
There's a good word.
A computer doesn't have sense. It can't sense what the intention of a composer is
Right.
or the emotion behind the music, the structure of the music. I mean, Bartok structured his pieces in many different ways. And for a computer to decide or an AI program to decide which structure to use or how to put them together or even what rhythms to use, because Bartok used a lot of irregular rhythms,
Right.
sometimes mixed up with regular ones. I think that those pieces cannot compete with the original creative thought of a composer. Nonetheless, I'm sure that people will try it, and I'm sure that people will play it and kind of dare audiences to know the difference.
Well. Hopefully it's too far in the future for me to concern myself with. So
Well, we can hope.
I'm so I'm sorry for such a weird question, but I had to ask.
No, it's a very interesting question. It made me ponder because it's not something I had really thought about. I know that AIs can spit out writing, for example, written word and summaries, and they can take notes of meetings and do all sorts of things. I hadn't really considered a program trying to imitate a certain composer.
So, well, I had read an article recently and seen a couple of other things about things that are going on in the world of popular music, rock and roll and country and such. And so I just, for whatever reason, I just kind of, I was preparing for this and I thought, gee, I wonder if, you know, which gives you an idea. Apparently I wasn't getting enough sleep that day. Not enough coffee or something. I'm not sure. So, Terry, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me. I so appreciate it. Good luck with the series. I hope it goes very well.
You.
The first concert is when?
November 6th, Thursday,
November 6th. Okay.
November 6th, at 7:30 at WOW Recital Hall. That would be Alexander Kobrin, a former Van Cliburn Gold
Oh,
Medal winner.
I bet that's wonderful.
Wonderful pianist. He'll be performing Haydn, Schubert, and Schumann. And all are welcome. Tickets are on sale, Carnegie Hall website and box office. And you can visit my website, keypianist.com, for his full bio, his full program.
There will be a link down there.
Wonderful. Thank you so
So
much for that.
yeah, so people should be able to get a hold of you easily, I hope.
Yes.
So
Well, thank you so much for having me.
thanks. It's
Lovely to.
definitely enjoyed talking to you. Thanks again. Let's
Likewise.
do this again sometime.
Love to. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'd like to thank Terry Eder for taking the time from her very busy schedule to talk with me. And thank you too for spending time with us. Hey, if you would like to keep up with her future adventures or any of my guests, just subscribe to my website. That's www.rogerhumphrey.com for my weekly blog. It's usually pretty short and even has some pretty pictures. And I promise, no spam. Ever. And in the meantime, grab some friends and check out some other episodes of Creative Conversations with Roger Humphrey.